I mean, have mean thoughts about anybody, even, is it? Gracious no, Scout. What's eating you? Well, coming out of the courthouse that night, Miss Gates was... She was going down the steps in front of us. You must have not seen her. She was talking with Miss Stephanie Crawford. I heard her say it's time somebody taught them a lesson. They were getting way above themselves, and the next thing they think they can do is marry us. Jim, how can you hate Hitler so bad and then turn around and be ugly about folks right at home? Jim was suddenly furious. He leaped off the bed, grabbed me by the collar, and shook me. I never want to hear about that courthouse again. Ever, ever. You hear me? You hear me? Don't you ever say one word to me about it again. You hear? Now go on. I was too surprised to cry. I crept from Jem's room and shut the door softly, lest undue noise set him off again. Suddenly tired, I wanted Atticus. He was in the living room, and I went to him and tried to get in his lap. Atticus smiled. You're getting so big now, I'll just have to hold a part of you. He held me close. Scout, he said softly, don't let Jem get you down. He's having a rough time these days. I heard you back there. Atticus said that Jem was trying hard to forget something, but what he was really doing was storing it away for a while, until enough time passed. Then he would be able to think about it and sort things out. When he was able to think about it, Jem would be himself again. Chapter 27. Things did settle down, after a fashion, as Atticus said they would. By the middle of October, only two small things out of the ordinary happened to two Maycomb citizens. No, there were three things, and they did not directly concern us, the Finches, but in a way they did. The first thing was that Mr. Bob Yule acquired and lost a job in a matter of days, and probably made himself unique in the annals of the 1930s. He was the only man I ever heard of who was fired from the WPA for laziness. I suppose his brief burst of fame brought on a briefer burst of industry, but his job lasted only as long as his notoriety. Mr. Yule found himself as forgotten as Tom Robinson. Thereafter, he resumed his regular weekly appearances at the welfare office for his check, and received it with no grace, amid obscure mutterings that the bastards who thought they ran this town wouldn't permit an honest man to make a living. Ruth Jones, the welfare lady, said Mr. Yule openly accused Atticus of getting his job. She was upset enough to walk down to Atticus's office and tell him about it. Atticus told Miss Ruth not to fret, that if Bob Yule wanted to discuss Atticus's getting his job, he knew the way to the office. The second thing happened to Judge Taylor. Judge Taylor was not a Sunday night churchgoer. Mrs. Taylor was. Judge Taylor savored his Sunday night hour alone in his big house, and church time found him holed up in his study, reading the writings of Bob Taylor, no kin, but the judge would have been proud to claim it. One Sunday night, lost in fruity metaphors and florid diction, Judge Taylor's attention was wrenched from the page by an irritating scratching noise. "Hush," he said to Ann Taylor, his fat, nondescript dog. Then he realized he was speaking to an empty room. The scratching noise was coming from the rear of the house. Judge Taylor clumped to the back porch to let Ann out, and found the screen door swinging open. A shadow on the corner of the house caught his eye, and that was all he saw of his visitor. Mrs. Taylor came home from church to find her husband in his chair, lost in the writings of Bob Taylor, with a shotgun across his lap. The third thing happened to Helen Robinson, Tom's widow. If Mr. Ewell was as forgotten as Tom Robinson, Tom Robinson was as forgotten as Boo Radley. But Tom was not forgotten by his employer, Mr. Link Diaz. Mr. Link Diaz made a job for Helen. He didn't really need her, but he said he felt right bad about the way things turned out. I never knew who took care of her children while Helen was away. Calpurnia said it was hard on Helen, because she had to walk nearly a mile out of her way to avoid the Yules, who, according to Helen, chunked at her the first time she tried to use the public road. Mr. Link Diaz eventually received the impression that Helen was coming to work each morning from the wrong direction, and dragged the reason out of her.
"Just let it be, Mr. Link, please, sir," Helen begged.
"The hell I will," said Mr. Link.
He told her to come by his store that afternoon before she left. She did, and Mr. Link closed his store, put his hat firmly on his head, and walked Helen home. He walked her the short way, by the Yules. On his way back, Mr. Link stopped at the crazy gate.
"Ewell!" he called. "I say, Ewell!"
The windows, normally packed with children, were empty.
"I know every last one of you's in there are laying on the floor. Now hear me, Bob Ewell. If I hear one more peep out of my girl Helen about not being able to walk this road, I'll have you in jail before sundown."
Mr. Link spat in the dust and walked home. Helen went to work next morning and used the public road. Nobody chunked at her, but when she was a few yards beyond the Ewell house, she turned around and saw Mr. Ewell walking behind her. She turned and walked on, and Mr. Ewell kept the same distance behind her until she reached Mr. Link Diaz's house. All the way to the house, Helen said, she heard a soft voice behind her crooning foul words. Thoroughly frightened, she telephoned Mr. Link at his store, which was not too far from his house. As Mr. Link came out of his store, he saw Bob Ewell leaning on the fence. Mr. Ewell said,
"Don't you look at me, Link Diaz, like I was dirt. I ain't jumped your—"
"First thing you can do, Ewell, is get your stinking carcass off my property. You're leaning on it, and I can't afford fresh paint for it. Second thing you can do is stay away from my cook, or I'll have you up for assault.
I ain't touched her, Link Diaz, and ain't about to go with no nigger."
"You don't have to touch her. All you have to do is make her afraid. And if assault ain't enough to keep you locked up a while, I'll get you in on the ladies' law. So get out of my sight. If you don't think I mean it, just bother that girl again."
Mr. Ewell evidently thought he meant it, for Helen reported no further trouble.
"I don't like it, Atticus. I don't like it at all," was Aunt Alexandra's assessment of these events. "That man seems to have a permanent running grudge against everybody connected with that case. I know how that kind are about paying off grudges, but I don't understand why he should harbor one. He had his way in court, didn't he?"
"I think I understand," said Atticus. "It might be because he knows in his heart that very few people in Macomb really believed his and Mayella's yarns. He thought he'd be a hero, but all he got for his pains was, okay, we'll convict this Negro, but get back to your dump. He's had his fling with about everybody now, so he ought to be satisfied. He'll settle down when the weather changes."
"But why should he try to burgle John Taylor's house? He obviously didn't know John was home, or he wouldn't have tried. Only lights John shows on Sunday nights are on the front porch and back in his den. You don't know if Bob Yule cut that screen. You don't know who did it, said Atticus. But I can guess. I proved him a liar, but John made him look like a fool. All the time Yule was on the stand, I couldn't dare look at John and keep a straight face. John looked at him as if he were a three-legged chicken or a square egg. Don't tell me judges don't try to prejudice juries, Atticus chuckled. By the end of October, our lives had become the familiar routine of school, play, study. Jem seemed to have put out of his mind whatever it was he wanted to forget, and our classmates mercifully let us forget our father's eccentricities. Cecil Jacobs asked me one time if Atticus was a radical. When I asked Atticus, Atticus was so amused I was rather annoyed, but he said he wasn't laughing at me. He said, "You tell Cecil, I'm about as radical as Cotton Tom Heflin." Aunt Alexandra was thriving. Miss Morty must have silenced the whole missionary society at one blow, for Auntie again ruled that roost. Her refreshments grew even more delicious. I learned more about the poor marooners' social life from listening to Mrs. Merriweather. They had so little sense of family that the whole tribe was one big family. A child had as many fathers as there were men in the community, as many mothers as there were women. J. Grimes Everett was doing his utmost to change this state of affairs, and desperately needed our prayers. Macomb was itself again, precisely the same as last year and the year before that, with only two minor changes. Firstly, people had removed from their store windows and automobiles the stickers that said NRA, We Do Our Part. I asked Atticus why, and he said it was because the National Recovery Act was dead. I asked who killed it. He said, 9 old men. The second change in Macomb since last year was not one of national significance. Until then, Halloween in Macomb was a completely unorganized affair. Each child did what he wanted to do, with assistance from other children if there was anything to be moved, such as placing a light buggy on top of the livery stable. But parents thought things went too far last year, when the peace of Miss Tootie and Miss Fruity was shattered. Mrs. Tootie and Fruity Barber were maiden ladies, sisters, who lived together in the only Macomb residence boasting a cellar. The Barber ladies were rumored to be Republicans, having migrated from Clanton, Alabama in 1911. Their ways were strange to us, and why they wanted a cellar nobody knew, but they wanted one, and they dug one, and they spent the rest of their lives chasing generations of children out of it. Mrs. Tootie and Fruity, their names were Sarah and Frances, aside from their Yankee ways, were both deaf. Miss Tootie denied it and lived in a world of silence. But Miss Fruity, not about to miss anything, employed an ear trumpet so enormous that Jem declared it was a loudspeaker from one of those dog victrolas. With these facts in mind, and Halloween at hand, some wicked children had waited until the Misses Barber were thoroughly asleep, slipped into their living room, nobody but the Radleys locked up at night, stealthily made away with every stick of furniture therein, and hid it in the cellar. I deny having taken part in such a thing. "I heard 'em," was the cry that awoke the Mrs. Barber's neighbors at dawn next morning. "Heard 'em driving our truck up to the door. Stomped around like horses. They're in New Orleans by now." Miss Tootie was sure those traveling fur sellers, who came through town 2 days ago, had purloined their furniture,
Dark they were, she said. Syrians.
Mr. Heck Tate was summoned. He surveyed the area and said he thought it was a local job. Miss Fruity said she'd know a Macomb voice anywhere, and there were no Macomb voices in that parlor last night. Rolling their R's all over her premises, they were. Nothing less than the bloodhounds must be used to locate their furniture, Miss Tootie insisted. So Mr. Tate was obliged to go 10 miles out the road, round up the county hounds, and put them on the trail. Mr. Tate started them off at the Mrs. Barber's front steps, but all they did was run around to the back of the house and howl at the cellar door. When Mr. Tate set them in motion 3 times, he finally guessed the truth. By noontime that day, there was not a barefooted child to be seen in Macomb, and nobody took off his shoes until the hounds were returned. So the Macomb ladies said things would be different this year. The high school auditorium would be open. There would be a pageant for the grown-ups, apple bobbing, taffy pulling, pinning the tail on the donkey for the children. There would also be a prize of 25 cents for the best Halloween costume created by the wearer. Jem and I both groaned. Not that we'd ever done anything. It was the principle of the thing. Jem considered himself too old for Halloween anyway. He said he wouldn't be caught anywhere near the high school at something like that. Oh, well, I thought, Atticus would take me. I soon learned, however, that my services would be required on stage that evening. Mrs. Grace Merriweather had composed an original pageant entitled Macomb County, Ad Astra Per Aspera, and I was to be a ham. She thought it would be adorable if some of the children were costumed to represent the county's agricultural products. Cecil Jacobs would be dressed up to look like a cow. Agnes Boone would make a lovely butter bean. Another child would be a peanut. And on down the line, until Mrs. Merriweather's imagination and the supply of children were exhausted. Our only duties, as far as I could gather from our 2 rehearsals, were to enter from stage left as Mrs. Merriweather, not only the author, but the narrator, identified us. When she called out, "Pork," that was my cue. Then the assembled company would sing, "Macomb County, Macomb County, we will I be true to thee," as the grand finale. And Mrs. Merriweather would mount the stage with the state flag. My costume was not much of a problem. Mrs. Crenshaw, the local seamstress, had as much imagination as Mrs. Merriweather. Mrs. Crenshaw took some chicken wire and bent it into the shape of a cured ham. This she covered with brown cloth and painted it to resemble the original. I could duck under, and someone would pull the contraption down over my head. It came almost to my knees. Mrs. Crenshaw thoughtfully left 2 peepholes for me. She did a fine job. Jem said I looked exactly like a ham with legs. There were several discomforts, though. It was hot. It was a close fit. If my nose itched, I couldn't scratch, and once inside, I could not get out of it alone. When Halloween came, I assumed that the whole family would be present to watch me perform, but I was disappointed. Atticus said as tactfully as he could that he just didn't think he could stand a pageant tonight. He was all in. He had been in Montgomery for a week and had come home late that afternoon. He thought Jem might escort me if I asked him. Aunt Alexandra said she just had to get to bed early. She had been decorating the stage all afternoon and was worn out. She stopped short in the middle of her sentence. She closed her mouth, then opened it to say something, but no words came. "'Smatter, Auntie?' I asked. "'Oh, nothing, nothing,' she said. "'Somebody just walked over my grave.' She put away from her whatever it was that gave her a pinprick of apprehension, and suggested that I give the family a preview in the living room. So Jem squeezed me into my costume, stood at the living room door, called, "Pork!" exactly as Mrs. Merriweather would have done, and I marched in. Atticus and Aunt Alexandra were delighted. I repeated my part for Calpurnia in the kitchen, and she said I was wonderful. I wanted to go across the street to show Miss Morty, but Jem said she'd probably be at the pageant anyway. After that, it didn't matter whether they went or not. Jem said he would take me. Thus began our longest journey together. Chapter 28. The weather was unusually warm for the last day of October. We didn't even need jackets. The wind was growing stronger, and Jem said it might be raining before we got home. There was no moon. The street light on the corner cast sharp shadows on the Radley house. I heard Jem laugh softly. "Bet nobody bothers them tonight," he said. Jem was carrying my ham costume, rather awkwardly, as it was hard to hold. I thought it gallant of him to do so. "It is a scary place, though, ain't it?" I said. "Boo doesn't mean anybody any harm, but I'm right glad you're along. You know Atticus wouldn't let you go to the schoolhouse by yourself," Jem said. "Don't see why. It's just around the corner and across the yard." "That yard's a mighty long place for little girls to cross at night," Jem teased. "Ain't you scared of haints?" We laughed. Haints, hot steams, incantations, secret signs had vanished with our years as mist with sunrise. "What was that old thing?" Jem said. "Angel bright, life in death, get off the road, don't suck my breath." "Cut it out now," I said. We were in front of the Radley place. Jem said, "Boo must not be at home. Listen." High above us, in the darkness, a solitary mocker poured out his repertoire in blissful unawareness of whose tree he sat in, plunging from the shrill kee-kee of the sunflower bird to the irascible quack of a blue jay, to the sad lament of "Poor Will, poor Will, poor Will." We turned the corner, and I tripped on a root growing in the road. Jem tried to help me, but all he did was drop my costume in the dust. I didn't fall, though, and soon we were on our way again. We turned off the road and entered the schoolyard. It was pitch black. "How do you know where we're at, Jem?" I asked when we had gone a few steps. "I can tell we're under the big oak because we're passing through a cool spot. Careful now, and don't fall again." We had slowed to a cautious gait and were feeling our way forward so as not to bump into the tree. The tree was a single and ancient oak. Two children could not reach around its trunk and touch hands. It was far away from teachers, their spies, and curious neighbors. It was near the Radley lot, but the Radleys were not curious. A small patch of earth beneath its branches was packed hard from many fights and furtive crap games. The lights in the high school auditorium were blazing in the distance, but they blinded us, if anything. "Don't look ahead, Scout," Jem said. "Look at the ground, and you won't fall." "You should have brought the flashlight, Jem." "Didn't know it was this dark. Didn't look like it'd be this dark earlier in the evening. So cloudy, that's why. It'll hold off a while, though." Someone leaped at us. "God almighty!" Jem yelled. A circle of light burst in our faces, and Cecil Jacobs jumped in glee behind it. "Gotcha!" he shrieked. "Thought you'd be coming along this way. What are you doing way out here by yourself, boy? Ain't you scared of Boo Radley?" Cecil had ridden safely to the auditorium with his parents, hadn't seen us, then had ventured down this far because he knew good and well we'd be coming along. He thought Mr. Finch'd be with us, though. "Shucks! Ain't much but around the corner," said Jem. "Who's scared to go around the corner?" We had to admit that Cecil was pretty good, though. He had given us a fright, and he could tell it all over the schoolhouse. That was his privilege. "Say," I said, "ain't you a cow tonight? Where's your costume?" "It's up behind the stage," he said. "Mrs. Merriweather says the pageant ain't coming on for a while. You can put yours back of the stage by mine, Scout, and we can go with the rest of 'em." This was an excellent idea, Jem thought. He also thought it a good thing that Cecil and I would be together. This way, Jem would be left to go with people his own age. When we reached the auditorium, the whole town was there except Atticus and the ladies worn out from decorating, and the usual outcasts and shut-ins. Most of the county, it seemed, was there. The hall was teeming with slicked-up country people. The high school building had a wide downstairs hallway. People milled around booths that had been installed along each side. "Oh, Jem, I forgot my money," I sighed when I saw them. "Atticus didn't," Jem said. "Here's 30 cents. You can do 6 things. See you later on." "Okay," I said, quite content with 30 cents and Cecil. I went with Cecil down to the front of the auditorium, through a door on one side, and backstage. I got rid of my ham costume and departed in a hurry, for Mrs. Merriweather was standing at a lectern in front of the first row of seats, making last-minute, frenzied changes in the script. "How much money you got?" I asked Cecil. Cecil had 30 cents, too, which made us even. We squandered our first nickels on the House of Horrors, which scared us not at all. We entered the black seventh-grade room and were led around by the temporary ghoul in residence, and were made to touch several objects alleged to be component parts of a human being. "Here's his eyes," we were told when we touched 2 peeled grapes on a saucer. "Here's his heart," which felt like raw liver. "These are his innards," and our hands were thrust into a plate of cold spaghetti. Cecil and I visited several booths. We each bought a sack of Mrs. Judge Taylor's homemade divinity. I wanted to bob for apples, but Cecil said it wasn't sanitary. His mother said he might catch something from everybody's heads having been in the same tub. "Ain't anything around town now to catch," I protested. But Cecil said his mother said it was unsanitary to eat after folks. I later asked Aunt Alexandra about this, and she said people who held such views were usually climbers. We were about to purchase a blob of taffy when Mrs. Merriweather's runners appeared and told us to go backstage. It was time to get ready. The auditorium was filling with people. The Macon County High School Band had assembled in front below the stage. The stage footlights were on, and the red velvet curtain rippled and billowed from the scurrying going on behind it. Backstage, Cecil and I found the narrow hallway teeming with people. Adults in homemade three-corner hats, Confederate caps, Spanish-American war hats, and World War helmets. Children dressed as various agricultural enterprises crowded around the one small window. "Somebody's mashed my costume," I wailed in dismay. Mrs. Merriweather galloped to me, reshaped the chicken wire, and thrust me inside. "You all right in there, Scout?" asked Cecil. "You sound so far off, like you was on the other side of a hill." "You don't sound any nearer," I said. The band played the national anthem, and we heard the audience rise. Then the bass drum sounded. Mrs. Merriweather, stationed behind her lectern beside the band, said, "Macon County, Ad astra per aspera. The bass drum boomed again. That means, said Mrs. Merriweather, translating for the rustic elements, from the mud to the stars. She added unnecessarily, it seemed to me, a pageant.
Reckon they wouldn't know what it was if she didn't tell 'em,
whispered Cecil, who was immediately shushed.
The whole town knows it,
I breathed.
But the country folks have come in,
Cecil said. Be quiet back there, a man's voice ordered, and we were silent. The bass drum went boom with every sentence Mrs. Merriweather uttered. She chanted mournfully about Macomb County being older than the state, that it was a part of the Mississippi and Alabama territories, that the first white man to set foot in the virgin forests was the probate judge's great-grandfather, five times removed, who was never heard of again. Then came the fearless Colonel Macomb, for whom the county was named. Andrew Jackson appointed him to a position of authority, and Colonel Macomb's misplaced self-confidence and slender sense of direction brought disaster to all who rode with him in the Creek Indian Wars. Colonel Macomb persevered in his efforts to make the region safe for democracy, but his first campaign was his last. His orders, relayed to him by a friendly Indian runner, were to move south. After consulting a tree to ascertain from its lichen which way was south, and taking no lip from the subordinates who ventured to correct him, Colonel Macomb set out on a purposeful journey to rout the enemy and entangled his troops so far northwest in the forest primeval that they were eventually rescued by settlers moving inland. Mrs. Merriweather gave a 30-minute description of Colonel Macomb's exploits. I discovered that if I bent my knees, I could tuck them under my costume and more or less sit. I sat down, listened to Mrs. Merriweather's drone and the bass drum's boom, and was soon fast asleep. They said later that Mrs. Merriweather was putting her all into the grand finale, that she had crooned pork with a confidence born of pine trees and butter beans entering on cue. She waited a few seconds, then called, pork? When nothing materialized, she yelled, pork! I must have heard her in my sleep, or the band playing Dixie woke me. But it was when Mrs. Merriweather triumphantly mounted the stage with the state flag that I chose to make my entrance. Chose is incorrect. I thought I'd better catch up with the rest of them. They told me later that Judge Taylor went out behind the auditorium and stood there slapping his knees so hard Mrs. Taylor brought him a glass of water and one of his pills. Mrs. Merriweather seemed to have a hit. Everybody was cheering so. But she caught me backstage and told me I had ruined her pageant. She made me feel awful. But when Jem came to fetch me, he was sympathetic. He said he couldn't see my costume much from where he was sitting. How he could tell I was feeling bad under my costume, I don't know. But he said I did all right. I just came in a little late. That was all. Jem was becoming almost as good as Atticus at making you feel right when things went wrong. Almost. Not even Jem could make me go through that crowd, and he consented to wait backstage with me until the audience left. You want to take it off, Scout? He asked. No, I'll just keep it on, I said. I could hide my mortification under it. You all want to ride home? Someone asked. No, sir, thank you, I heard Jem say. It's just a little walk. Be careful of Haints, the voice said. Better still, tell the Haints to be careful of Scout.
There aren't many folks left now, Jem told me. Let's go.
This ends Disc 10. To Kill a Mockingbird, Disc 11.
We went through the auditorium to the hallway, then down the steps. It was still black dark. The remaining cars were parked on the other side of the building, and their headlights were little help. If some of them were going in our direction, we could see better, said Jem. Here, Scout, let me hold on to your hock. You might lose your balance.
I can see all right.
Yeah, but you might lose your balance. I felt a slight pressure on my head and assumed that Jem had grabbed that end of the ham.
You got me?
Uh-huh. We began crossing the black schoolyard, straining to see our feet.
Jem, I said, I forgot my shoes. They're back behind the stage.
Well, let's go get 'em. But as we turned around, the auditorium lights went off.
You can get 'em tomorrow, he said. But tomorrow's Sunday, I protested, as Jem turned me homeward. You can get the janitor to let you in.
Scout? Nothing. Jem hadn't started that in a long time. I wondered what he was thinking. He'd tell me when he wanted to, probably when we got home. I felt his fingers press the top of my costume, too hard, it seemed. I shook my head.
Jem, you don't have to...
Hush a minute, Scout, he said, pinching me. We walked along silently.
Minutes up, I said. What you thinking about?
I turned to look at him, but his outline was barely visible. Thought I heard something, he said. Stop a minute. We stopped. Hear anything? He asked.
No.
We had not gone 5 paces before he made me stop again.
Jem, are you trying to scare me? You know I'm too old.
Be quiet, he said, and I knew he was not joking. The night was still. I could hear his breath coming easily beside me. Occasionally there was a sudden breeze that hit my bare legs, but it was all that remained of a promised windy night. This was the stillness before a thunderstorm. We listened.
Heard an old dog just then, I said.
It's not that, Jem answered.
I hear it when we're walking along, but when we stop, I don't hear it. You hear my costume rustling. Oh, it's just Halloween got you.
I said it more to convince myself than Jem, for sure enough, as we began walking, I heard what he was talking about. It was not my costume.
It's just old Cecil, said Jem presently. He won't get us again. Let's don't let him think we're hurrying.
We slowed to a crawl. I asked Jem how Cecil could follow us in this dark. Looked to me like he'd bump into us from behind.
I can see you, Scout, Jem said. How? I can't see you.
Your fat streaks are showing.
Mrs. Crenshaw painted them with some of that shiny stuff so they'd show up under the footlights.
I can see you pretty well, and I expect Cecil can see you well enough to keep his distance.
I would show Cecil that we knew he was behind us and we were ready for him.
Cecil Jacobs is a big wet hen,
I yelled suddenly, turning around. We stopped. There was no acknowledgement, save hen bouncing off the distant schoolhouse wall.
I'll get him, said Jem. Hey!
Hey, 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 answered the schoolhouse wall. It was unlike Cecil to hold out for so long. Once he pulled a joke, he'd repeat it time and again. We should have been leapt at already. Jem signaled for me to stop again. He said softly, Scout, can you take that thing off?
I think so, but I ain't got anything on under it much.
I've got your dress here.
I can't get it on in the dark.
Okay, he said. Never mind.
Jem, are you afraid?
No. Think we're almost to the tree now. Few yards from that, and we'll be to the road. We can see the street light then. Jem was talking in an unhurried, flat, toneless voice. I wondered how long he would try to keep the Cecil myth going.
You reckon we ought to sing, Jem?
No. Be real quiet again, Scout. We had not increased our pace. Jem knew as well as I that it was difficult to walk fast without stumping a toe, tripping on stones, and other inconveniences, and I was barefooted. Maybe it was the wind rustling the trees. But there wasn't any wind, and there weren't any trees except the big oak. Our company shuffled and dragged his feet, as if wearing heavy shoes. Whoever it was wore thick cotton pants. What I thought were trees rustling was the soft swish of cotton on cotton, weak, weak, with every step. I felt the sand go cold under my feet, and I knew we were near the big oak. Jem pressed my head. We stopped and listened. Shufflefoot had not stopped with us this time. His trousers swished softly and steadily. Then they stopped. He was running, running toward us with no child's steps.
"Run, Scout! Run! Run!"
Jem screamed. I took one giant step and found myself reeling. My arms useless, in the dark. I could not keep my balance.
"Jem! Jem! Help me, Jem!"
Something crushed the chicken wire around me. Metal ripped on metal, and I fell to the ground and rolled as far as I could, floundering to escape my wire prison. From somewhere nearby came scuffling, kicking sounds, sounds of shoes and flesh scraping dirt and roots. Someone rolled against me, and I felt Jem. He was up like lightning, and pulling me with him. But though my head and shoulders were free, I was so entangled we didn't get very far. We were nearly to the road when I felt Jem's hand leave me, felt him jerk backwards to the ground. More scuffling, and there came a dull crunching sound, and Jem screamed. I ran in the direction of Jem's scream and sank into a flabby male stomach. Its owner said, "Oof!" and tried to catch my arms, but they were tightly pinioned. His stomach was soft, but his arms were like steel. He slowly squeezed the breath out of me. I could not move. Suddenly, he was jerked backwards and flung on the ground, almost carrying me with him. I thought, "Jem's up." One's mind works very slowly at times. Stunned, I stood there dumbly. The scuffling noises were dying. Someone wheezed, and the night was still again. Still, but for a man breathing heavily. Breathing heavily and staggering. I thought he went to the tree and leaned against it. He coughed violently, a sobbing, bone-shaking cough.
"Jem?"
There was no answer but the man's heavy breathing.
"Jem?"
Jem didn't answer. The man began moving around, as if searching for something. I heard him groan and pull something heavy along the ground. It was slowly coming to me that there were now four people under the tree.
"Atticus?"
The man was walking heavily and unsteadily toward the road. I went to where I thought he had been and felt frantically along the ground, reaching out with my toes. Presently I touched someone.
"Jem?"
My toes touched trousers, a belt buckle, buttons, something I could not identify, a collar, and a face. A prickly stubble on the face told me it was not Jem's. I smelled stale whiskey.
I made my way along in what I thought was the direction of the road. I was not sure, because I had been turned around so many times, but I found it and looked down to the streetlight. A man was passing under it. The man was walking with the staccato steps of someone carrying a load too heavy for him. He was going around the corner. He was carrying Jem. Jem's arm was dangling crazily in front of him. By the time I reached the corner, the man was crossing our front yard. Light from our front door framed Atticus for an instant. He ran down the steps, and together he and the man took Jem inside. I was at the front door when they were going down the hall. Aunt Alexandra was running to meet me. "Call Dr. Reynolds!" Atticus' voice came sharply from Jem's room. "Where's Scout?"
"Here she is,"
Aunt Alexandra called, pulling me along with her to the telephone. She tugged at me anxiously.
"I'm all right, Auntie," I said. "You better call."
She pulled the receiver from the hook and said, "You LeMay, get Dr. Reynolds, quick.
Agnes, is your father home? Oh, God, where is he? Please, tell him to come over here as soon as he comes in. Please, it's urgent."
There was no need for Aunt Alexandra to identify herself. People in Macomb knew each other's voices. Atticus came out of Jem's room. The moment Aunt Alexandra broke the connection, Atticus took the receiver from her. He rattled the hook, then said, "You LeMay, get me the sheriff, please." "Heck, Atticus Finch. Someone's been after my children. Jem's hurt. Between here and the schoolhouse. I can't leave my boy. Run out there for me, please, and see if he's still around. Doubt if you'll find him now, but I'd like to see him if you do. Got to go now. Thanks, Heck."
"Atticus, is Jem dead?"
"No, Scout."
"Look after her, sister," he called as he went down the hall.
Aunt Alexandra's fingers trembled as she unwound the crushed fabric and wire from around me.
"Are you all right, darling?"
she asked over and over as she worked me free. It was a relief to be out. My arms were beginning to tingle, and they were red with small hexagonal marks. I rubbed them, and they felt better.
"Auntie, is Jem dead?"
"No. No, darling, he's unconscious. We won't know how badly he's hurt until Dr. Reynolds gets here.
Jean Louise, what happened?"
"I don't know."
She left it at that. She brought me something to put on, and had I thought about it then, I would have never let her forget it. In her distraction, Auntie brought me my overalls.
"Put these on, darling," she said, handing me the garment she most despised.
She rushed back to Jem's room, then came to me in the hall. She patted me vaguely and went back to Jem's room. A car stopped in front of the house. I knew Dr. Reynolds' step almost as well as my father's. He had brought Jem and me into the world, had led us through every childhood disease known to man, including the time Jem fell out of the treehouse, and he had never lost our friendship. Dr. Reynolds said if we had been boil-prone, things would have been different, but we doubted it. He came in the door and said, "Good Lord!" He walked toward me, said, "You're still standing," and changed his course. He knew every room in the house. He also knew that if I was in bad shape, so was Jem. After 10 forevers, Dr. Reynolds returned.
"Is Jem dead?" I asked.
"Far from it," he said, squatting down to me. "He's got a bump on the head just like yours, and a broken arm. Scout, look that way. No, don't turn your head, roll your eyes. Now look over yonder."
He's got a bad break. So far as I can tell now, it's in the elbow. Like somebody tried to wring his arm off. Now look at me.
Then he's not dead?
No. Dr. Reynolds got to his feet. We can't do much tonight, he said, except try to make him as comfortable as we can. We'll have to x-ray his arm. Looks like he'll be wearing his arm way out by his side for a while. Don't worry, though. He'll be as good as new. Boys his age bounce.
While he was talking, Dr. Reynolds had been looking keenly at me, lightly fingering the bump that was coming on my forehead.
You don't feel broke anywhere, do you?
Dr. Reynolds's small joke made me smile.
Then you don't think he's dead, then?
He put on his hat.
Now, I may be wrong, of course, but I think he's very alive. Shows all the symptoms of it. Go have a look at him, and when I come back, we'll get together and decide.
Dr. Reynolds's step was young and brisk. Mr. Heck Tate's was not. His heavy boots punished the porch, and he opened the door awkwardly. But he said the same thing Dr. Reynolds said when he came in.
You all right, Scout? He added.
Yes, sir. I'm going in to see Jem. Atticus and them's in there.
I'll go with you, said Mr. Tate.
Aunt Alexandra had shaded Jem's reading light with a towel, and his room was dim. Jem was lying on his back. There was an ugly mark along one side of his face. His left arm lay out from his body. His elbow was bent slightly, but in the wrong direction. Jem was frowning.
Jem?
Attica spoke.
He can't hear you, Scout. He's out like a light. He was coming around, but Dr. Reynolds put him out again.
Yes, sir. I retreated.
Jem's room was large and square. Aunt Alexandra was sitting in a rocking chair by the fireplace. The man who brought Jem in was standing in a corner, leaning against the wall. He was some countryman I did not know. He had probably been at the pageant and was in the vicinity when it happened. He must have heard our screams and come running. Atticus was standing by Jem's bed. Mr. Heck Tate stood in the doorway. His hat was in his hand, and a flashlight bulged from his pants pocket. He was in his working clothes.
Come in, Heck, said Atticus. Did you find anything? I can't conceive of anyone low down enough to do a thing like this, but I hope you found him.
Mr. Tate sniffed. He glanced sharply at the man in the corner, nodded to him, then looked around the room, at Jem, at Aunt Alexandra, then at Atticus.
Sit down, Mr. Finch, he said pleasantly.
Atticus said,
Let's all sit down. Have that chair, Heck. I'll get another one from the living room.
Mr. Tate sat in Jem's desk chair. He waited until Atticus returned and settled himself. I wondered why Atticus had not brought a chair for the man in the corner, but Atticus knew the ways of country people far better than I. Some of his rural clients would park their long-eared steeds under the chinaberry trees in the backyard, and Atticus would often keep appointments on the back steps. This one was probably more comfortable where he was.
Mr. Finch, said Mr. Tate, tell you what I found. I found a little girl's dress. It's out there in my car. That your dress, Scout?
Yes, sir. If it's a pink one with smocking, I said.
Mr. Tate was behaving as if he were on the witness stand. He liked to tell things his own way, untrammeled by state or defense, and sometimes it took him a while.
I found some funny-looking pieces of muddy-colored cloth.
That's my costume, Mr. Tate.
Mr. Tate ran his hands down his thighs. He rubbed his left arm and investigated Jem's mantelpiece. Then he seemed to be interested in the fireplace. His fingers sought his long nose.
"What is it, Heck?" said Atticus.
Mr. Tate found his neck and rubbed it.
"Bob Yule's lying on the ground under that tree down yonder, with a kitchen knife stuck up under his ribs. He's dead, Mr. Finch."
Chapter 29. Aunt Alexandra got up and reached for the mantelpiece. Mr. Tate rose, but she declined assistance. For once in his life, Atticus's instinctive courtesy failed him. He sat where he was. Somehow, I could think of nothing but Mr. Bob Yule saying he'd get Atticus if it took him the rest of his life. Mr. Yule almost got him, and it was the last thing he did.
"Are you sure?"
Atticus said bleakly.
"He's dead, all right," said Mr. Tate. "He's good and dead. He won't hurt these children again."
"I didn't mean that." Atticus seemed to be talking in his sleep. His age was beginning to show, his one sign of inner turmoil. The strong line of his jaw melted a little. One became aware of telltale creases forming under his ears. One noticed not his jet-black hair, but the gray patches growing at his temples. "Hadn't we better go to the living room?" Aunt Alexandra said at last.
"If you don't mind," said Mr. Tate, "I'd rather us stay in here, if it won't hurt Jem any. I want to have a look at his injuries while Scout tells us about it."
"Is it all right if I leave?" she asked. "I'm just one person too many in here. I'll be in my room if you want me, Atticus." Aunt Alexandra went to the door, but she stopped and turned. "Atticus, I had a feeling about this tonight. This is my fault," she began. "I should have..." Mr. Tate held up his hand.
"You go ahead, Miss Alexandra. I know it's been a shock to you. And don't you fret yourself about anything. Why, if we followed our feelings all the time, we'd be like cats chasing their tails. Miss Scout, see if you can tell us what happened, while it's still fresh in your mind. You think you can? Did you see him following you?"
I went to Atticus and felt his arms go around me. I buried my head in his lap.
"We started home. I said, 'Jem, I forgot my shoes.' Soon as we started back for 'em, the lights went out. Jem said I could get 'em tomorrow."
"Scout, raise up so Mr. Tate can hear you," Atticus said. I crawled into his lap. "Then Jem said, 'Hush a minute.' I thought he was thinking. He always wants you to hush so he can think. Then he said he heard something. We thought it was Cecil."
"Cecil?"
"Cecil Jacobs. He scared us once tonight, and we thought it was him again. He had on a sheet. They gave a quarter for the best costume. I don't know who won it."
"Where were you when you thought it was Cecil?"
"Just a little piece from the schoolhouse. I yelled something at him."
"You yelled what?"
"Cecil Jacobs is a big fat hen, I think." "We didn't hear nothing. Then Jem yelled, 'Hello,' or something loud enough to wake the dead."
"Just a minute, Scout," said Mr. Tate. "Mr. Finch, did you hear them?"
Atticus said he didn't. He had the radio on. Aunt Alexandra had hers going in her bedroom. He remembered because she told him to turn his down a bit so she could hear hers. Atticus smiled.
"I always play a radio too loud." I wonder if the neighbors heard anything, said Mr. Tate. I doubt it, Heck. Most of them listen to their radios or go